I'm Thomas Law, the Executive Director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. Every function in companies is being impacted by AI. Every functional leader is being asked, how can you leverage AI to improve your operations? Good old fuddy finance is no exception. Today, I'm joined by Cormac Whelan, the CEO of Nitro Software, and their tagline is making your documents and workflows simple, smart, and secure. And today we'll be discussing how to be competitive in a very crowded software market segment. So let's get the Insight engine humming here. Cormac, welcome to Tectonic. It's nice to see you. This is Inside Baseball here for folks. This is the second time we've tried to do this. We had all kinds of technical issues the first time, but you're sitting in Dublin. I'm sitting in Columbus, Ohio. Right now it's working. So we're going to, I think, have a great conversation today. And I wanted to get you on Tectonic because, you know, what you are facing in your market segment is a pattern that I'm seeing across a lot of software segments. And that is you have massive incumbents that are in there, big companies like an Adobe or a DocuSign. But then there are smaller companies like Nitro that come in and they're promising a simpler value. And then you have AI coming in and rewriting the rules for everybody, whether you're a big incumbent or a smaller company. Do you agree with that framing? Is that what you see going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you, Thomas, for having me and delighted to be here. Yeah, I mean, look, we see AI as the great equalizer, right? It gives the small guys a chance against the big guys. You know, we can do stuff with like 10 or 15 guys that traditionally you had to throw 200 or 300 people at, or 200 or 300 engineers. And we are not one of the incumbents. You know, we don't have 300 guys to throw at these problems. And, you know, we have a very AI-centric management team and kind of product and engineering teams. And so we see it as an equalizer. It allows an established challenger like us to the incumbent kind of be a little bit bigger, be a little bit closer, move a little bit faster, and deliver real value to customers.
Yeah, I mean, the term I like to use is you can punch above your weight class, for sure. It's a different game. Now, I want to flip the coin a little bit here. And so when you are up against an incumbent, a larger company, what's the biggest advantage that they have from your perspective? Is it, you know, distribution? Is it, they just have brand awareness? Is it because procurement knows who they are? What are the biggest advantages you're dealing with?
Yeah, I would say that brand awareness and procurement inertia is the biggest, right? The enterprises have other products embedded in their stack, and switching always feels risky for them. And, you know, the old saying, nobody ever got fired for hiring IBM. And, you know, we absolutely compete with some of the bigger brands of our day in Adobe and DocuSign. So that's probably the first hurdle we have to get past. Who are you? Who is Nitro? And we're fortunate to be able to have 70% of the Fortune 500 as customers. So that definitely helps in that challenge. The security and trust also, it's again, and I think some of that comes from their brand. Everybody just assumes they have that. And we've seen places where those incumbents have been more challenged in terms of security and trust. And so we have to work really hard. We have a maniacal focus on kind of trust and security internally, because, you know, we can't ever afford to slip up in the way, you know, some of the bigger incumbents have more recently. And then just bundling is increasingly a factor. Yeah, like where companies and bigger companies in times of uncertainty and in times of where the kind of value in the market is harder to understand, they tend to want to put everything into one sort of software real estate patch. And, you know, that's definitely something we have to face into as well.
Yeah, correct. True. And so let's flip it around. So what are some of your natural advantages, right, that you come in there? And again, is it simplicity? Is it pricing? Is it, you mentioned security and trust. What are some of your strengths that you play against what we just talked about?
Well, like we would say value first. So, you know, we're not an incumbent. We're not trying to squeeze the market or the customer for that extra dollar. We want to be the value player. We want to provide the same capability for probably a slightly more economic outcome for the customer. I would say that that's definitely something like transparency, you know, trust and intimacy are sort of three keywords for us. We are smaller, and our advantage is we can be a little bit more intimate and closer to the customer and understand what the customer is trying to do, why they're looking to move, what are the real challenges internally. It's not just there's somebody who's running this project on the other end of it. There's outcomes that they're trying to get to. They're trying to impress their boss. Understanding what are the things that their company are trying to do, what are the things their organization is trying to do. Leverage that intimacy and that closeness and the fact that we are a little bit smaller. And then the transparency of really helping them understand how their users are engaging with the products and how their users use the products every day and where we think that they get value and where we think they don't get as much value from it. And being quite open and transparent about that, even though that might sometimes lead to challenge on the contract side, being a really good partner to the company as a smaller company, those are the places where we can, you know, we can take advantage of our size.
So I hear a couple things there. I mean, obviously one is around value. You know, look, our goal is to provide same capability, better price point, et cetera. But the other thing I heard there was around customer intimacy. It sounds like the willingness to really engage with the customer in a more intimate way to really understand what they're trying to do that maybe a larger company. And also give the audience a sense of, you know, what's your sweet spot in terms of customer size? Like, you know, how big are these companies that are ideal for you?
So 60% of our revenue today, our ARR today, would be from like what we would call enterprise and strategic size businesses. They would be businesses from 5,000 employees and up. And then the other 40%, yeah, so they're all like, you know, and then the other 40% of our revenue would be from sort of mid-market and SMB, more traditional like providers or more traditional size customers. We're lucky in that the space we play, that PDF workflow, sign-centric solutions, that applies to almost any business. It's a very horizontal business. It's one of the reasons we came to this. Like, this is a global horizontal business that whether you're a mom and pop shop or whether you're Deutsche Bank, you can take advantage of our products and the problems we try and solve.
Yeah. So large potential TAM there, which is good. And so what you just said, I mean, you're dealing with, you know, very large companies on the mid-sized companies. When you're going, you know, let's say to a large company, what is the catalyst for them to be willing to displace an incumbent, right? To somebody that they've been working with, a larger brand, and then they say, no, actually, we want to place a bet here on Nitro. What triggers that?
To be honest with you, like certainly value and economics often trigger it. Poor adoption of their products and poor partnership from the incumbent, you know, letting them know, like one of our competitors is they're almost opaque about what the users are doing with the product because they don't want you to know that, you know, 20% of your users haven't actually used the product in the last like 3 months. And we're much more transparent about that kind of stuff so that we want to help our businesses and our users get value, engage with the products and solve problems for them. And so, and then the last piece is security concerns are definitely a trigger. Some of the bigger incumbents, they're probably a little bit more under attack and under pressure there. And that's definitely opened opportunities for us. And we have a very explicit way about how we talk about that and how we address that to make sure we're not creating the same concerns for the customer.
Yeah. And again, a lot of our members are enterprise software companies. And I think that a really tough lesson that is being learned, big time in the past year and a half, 2 years, is that you'd have this install base, you'd have these renewals, and you could have a relatively light touch and kind of count on those renewals. And then those days kind of went away because to your point, if they found that people weren't using the software, if they didn't feel there was really value there, they're reexamining all their tech spend. And so you're out the door if you don't have that intimacy and you're not proving that value. But you know, the other thing that we're seeing is the approval process for any type of enterprise software spend has gone up the food chain, right? So now it's sort of, you know, a CFO decision to say, are we going to spend money on that or not? And so, you know, when you're talking to clients, whether it's renewal, whether it's a net new customer, what is the language or the messaging that you find is resonates with that executive level of why they want to either go with Nitro or renew with Nitro?
So definitely the challenge of where value lies in the business, that closeness to the customer, you know, is something we talk about, but also being able to face into the info security, you know, information security challenges, whether it's APIs or cloud, like even having their most precious IP tends to be in the documents through the organization, like whether it's in your procurement team, whether it's the manuals for your new products or your new drugs, whether it's employment contracts and employment offers, you know, so that most precious data, making sure that we can answer the information security concerns around that on how we manage that. That's why that maniacal focus on that trust and security is a big piece for a small company like us.
Yeah. You know, I think that the chair you're sitting in, CEO of a enterprise software company, has become exponentially harder over the past couple of years. I really do. And so I'm curious, as you wake up every day, what are sort of the top things that are consuming your mind as a CEO of a software company right now?
That's a great question. I think that making sure that as we get better at understanding our customers, that we don't lose that intimacy and that touch, that is, you've heard me repeat that a little bit. I think that's a core part of our differentiation. 3 million licensed users, we've 13,000 some businesses. We're lucky enough to have 70% of the Fortune 500 as customers. And making sure that the product velocity is there, the user intimacy, the workflow intimacy. And then, we are under challenge from the incumbents every day, to make sure that we retain our customers. Recently in 2025, we crossed over 100 million in ARR. And I think we have a clear line of sight of how to get to 200 million in ARR. Mm-hmm. But the first thing we have to do every day is make sure that we protect the 100 million personally.
Yep, for sure.
And so that customer retention and expansion comes from that intimacy and understanding.
The economics of enterprise tech are breaking. AI startups are threatening the domain of long-established enterprise technology providers. Yet, it is unclear exactly how technology providers will drive profitable revenue in the AI era. TSIA has always been focused on what it takes to have a profitable business model in enterprise tech. AI economics is a body of actionable TSIA research that is digging into the future of tech business models. How will AI solutions be priced? What does the next generation tech services portfolio look like? And why does TSIA believe that it is not the end of tech services, but the era of services? Go to tsia.com/AI economics to learn the answers. I want to click into this because you keep using this theme of customer intimacy. And I want to talk about how you think about customer intimacy in the current era. And what I'll put on the table here is we're watching company after company rethink its customer engagement models. And there is a couple big drivers here. So one driver is what you just put on the table is like, hey, obviously we got to protect this install base, retain, become top of mind for every software company. The other big lever, though, is everybody is figuring out how to drive efficiency. I think I'm remembering correctly, it's stunning. The technology industry laid off more people already this year than they did all of last year. And last year was a record year for layoffs. So this is an industry that is really intent on reducing headcount. But when we watch this happen, when that balance between customer-facing headcount, do I need these roles? Do I not need these roles? Can I just use digital motions for customers to self-serve, et cetera? There's a lot of pressure there on that. So as a CEO, and again, I'm sure you are under the same type of pressure to say, hey, your board's saying, show me how you're making yourself more efficient every day, every quarter. How are you thinking through protecting customer intimacy, but also being as efficient and as effective as possible?
Absolutely. To give a very practical example, when we talk about customer intimacy, one of our bigger customers is in the clinical medical trial space. They're one of the biggest providers in the world. We have 40,000 users there. When we started looking at the telemetry and what they're doing every day, we found out that they had 6,000 people who were doing redaction manually every month.
Okay.
And that they had spent like 1 million minutes in the past year redacting. And so using that intimacy to go in, look at our product set, leverage our kind of AI knowledge, leverage our document and workflow knowledge to go build a sort of smarter redact tool. And so that ability to take PII and PHI data out of a document in seconds, prompted. So not taking the human out of the loop, keeping the human in the loop, but making the human ever more efficient. And the example being, when we expanded that view to our customer base, Thomas, we found that across our customer base in 2025, our customers spent 29 million minutes doing redaction.
Mm-hmm.
29, like that's almost 60 years. And so today, our Smart Redact product, which we brought out to the market, the average user can take a 10 or 20 page document. They can do it in 30 or 60 seconds versus something that took them 30 or 40 minutes a year ago. And so that's where that intimacy allows a smaller company like us, that understanding, step ahead in functionality of, and I'll call them out, an Adobe or a DocuSign, right? And we've all seen the stuff with the Epstein files, and it's timely. But that ability to do things in a more efficient, empowering the user, and then for them to take that same capability and apply that to 100 documents or 1,000 documents, so that, you know, you just superpower the individual to solve problems. That's why that intimacy for a company our size is so important, Thomas. And then on the other side of it is, how do we get that same efficiency inside our business? Our legal team, our finance team, our marketing team, we're looking at AI throughout our organization. Over the course of the last year, we've been experimenting with our product and engineering teams. We absolutely have engineers in our engineering team who haven't coded in the last like 3 or 4 months. They've been leveraging AI to do that. Yep. And so bringing that efficiency to bear so that, again, the small company can take on the great companies, just be that little closer, that little bit more efficient, have a little bit of more pace and capability to what we do against the bigger incumbents. So does that kind of give you a sense?
Yeah, it does. And I'll go to the first part of your response there. And this example of having intimacy to identify this massive issue one customer had with redaction, and then you can, you know, propagate that to other customers. But being able to say, look, we can put a lot of value on the table by understanding your workflow, understanding where you're losing time, how we can now leverage new AI capabilities to solve that. I guess what I'm chipping on here, I believe it's those motions that customers more and more are expecting from their technology vendors, that's what they're going to value. It's going to keep you in play, right? You're constantly unlocking new types of value. But that, I believe deeply, is a combination of your ever-emerging technical capabilities plus your customer-facing people, whether it's your salespeople, your CSMs, your PS people, whoever. You got to have both in play to unlock that. And I get a little bit worried right now in the industry. At TSI, we talk about two parts of the sentence. The first part of the sentence is for a CEO, you know, we want to leverage AI to reduce the amount of people we need. Okay. But the second part of the sentence is, actually, we want to leverage AI to unlock, you know, like, what are we going to do, right? Instead of the old stuff, what's the new stuff, like, you know, that use case here? And I think it's that balance is so important, right? To sort of repurpose what people were doing in the old world in new ways to do it, unlock new value propositions for customers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, to your point, you talked about, you know, those customer-facing people. That becomes your greatest intelligence tool. Everybody in my business who talks to a customer, whether a sales guy, whether one of my sales engineers, whether a BDR, or, you know, our customer service managers or our support people, all of that is an intelligence gathering mechanism, you know, to understand what those customers are going through. Why are they struggling? What are the things that would make their day easier? And, you know, how do we empower that user, and how do we take the complexity out of what they're doing every day and make it easier? And then you have to leverage AI and technology, right, as an augmentation to that talent. Our view on AI in particular is, and we've absolutely had this question for our employees, you know, are we going to use this as an opportunity to reduce headcount? No. What I want to do is I want to augment the capability that I have. I have 100 engineers and product people. I don't have, you know, 500 or 5,000 like the guys we compete against. But how do I move product at a pace that is competitive to those big guys? And I think that's one of the big changes that's happened over the last 12 months, is that I think the small can take on the large companies, you know, and provide real value to customers.
Yeah. So let's click into that more, because, I mean, how do you see that landscape changing again? Because I think historically in any market, there's always been large incumbents. There's been, you know, people chipping on that coming in. But now AI, I think, does, as you've been putting on the table here, really does change the equation. It is very levels the playing field in new ways. You know, what I see is it gives these smaller, you know, companies a lot of advantage, like you said, to be nimble and also to be able to punch way above your weight in terms of releasing products, et cetera. How do you see this unfolding? I mean, what's an ideal software company look like a couple of years down the road with AI in play?
That's a great question, Thomas. I think we have to shift how we think about our business, how we think about our business model, how we think about the value levers with customers and with the market. Yep. And I think the companies that are going to win are the companies who are the most agile and the most intimate. And that's a constant challenge. It's something I, as the CEO, I challenge, you know, not just in my management team, but in all the rooms at Nitro on a daily basis, because I've been doing this for a long time, like over 25 years as a CEO in public and private companies. So I've lived through the dot-com bomb, cloud, you know, the Great Recession, and some of the real shifts in the market, yeah. You know, data going from client server to distributed and all of the changes therein. The changes that we are now seeing over the course of the last 12 months, and I think over the course of the next 12 months, they're changing on a weekly and biweekly basis yeah. now. And so that means our business has to change. Like, the incumbents are bigger. They do have that brand recognition, that brand inertia. We don't. And so we have got to start to learn as a company how we move at the pace that the market is moving.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to put on the table sort of TSI's thesis on this and sort of a North Star, because you're right. I mean, visibility, I think, is so low for every company because things are changing so quickly, right? I mean, just the technology's changing and what customers expect, all this kind of fun stuff. And so everybody's trying to navigate that. And like you said, rethinking their business model, what are the value levers? This is our working thesis on this. So if you think historically in an enterprise software company as a service type model, the superpower was to get an install base and point to the recurring revenues and how those recurring revenues were growing. I mean, that's the superpower, right? And that's what investors valued and that's what they wanted to hear about, et cetera. And so a lot of that was buy growth, just get people on the pile and just keep churn manageable, right? And we believe deeply that the superpower and how people are going to keep both revenue and margin on the table is maniacal focus on value realization. That is where the game is going to be played. So a lot of things that you're talking about, you know, again, customer intimacy, really understanding where to deliver value, you know, being able to play that game and saying, look, it is a combination of our product, our service motions, et cetera. If we can constantly deliver value and we just can do that at an industrial level, right? We really engineer that into the way we engage with the customer. That's what customers are going to gravitate to in this new era. But I think, quite frankly and sadly, a lot of enterprise software companies, that's not their superpower, not value realization. It's sticking the initial landing, getting customers to buy, and then I got to go move on to the next, you know, the next land. Does that make sense?
And you say a maniacal focus on value realization. We say a maniacal focus on delivering outcomes, right? We really have to understand. Yeah. So it's not just about delivering a software application. It's sitting into every user in a business at a Deutsche Bank or a bank in New York and going, what are they trying to do every day? How do I deliver a better outcome? You know, how do I let them get to the stuff that they're, whatever their domain experts in, that they spend the rest of their day doing in the high value things yeah. that their company needs them to be paying attention to. And I can take them out of the mundane and sort of make it easy. You know, one of the things that we also say internally is that, you know, the best AI is AI that's boring. Right? It should just be in the background. It should yeah. just be, you shouldn't yeah. even know you're interacting, but it's, oh my God, that was just so simple to do. Redaction, our document assistant, those kind of like table, like extract, our form extract capability. You just make it easier and ever more elegant. And that delivering of outcomes, I think that's that shift. And actually, I think that smaller companies are actually in a better position to make that shift than the larger incumbent companies. And that's what we're excited about.
Yeah, and I agree again with that assertion about smaller companies being more able to embrace this. Every Tectonic listener is well aware, I am a big believer that AI is a game changer for how professionals in the technology industry will do their jobs. TSI Research is not immune to that reality. I am proud to say that we have been aggressively experimenting on how AI can change the way we create research and deliver those research insights to our members. And now we are ready to release TSIA Intelligence, the first Gen AI model designed exclusively for technology services. Unlike generic Gen AI tools, TSIA Intelligence taps into our real-world, industry-validated data that is not in the public domain. We have designed this model to give you clear, actionable and board-ready insights. Right now, in technology services, the stakes are really high. Every decision counts. Good decisions can build your career. Bad ones can end it. General LLMs are incredibly powerful, but you need specialized insights built on industry data that you can trust. That is TSI Intelligence. To check it out, visit tsi.com/intelligence. then I'll put another thesis that we have on the table in terms of where things are going. And that is just around pricing. So we've been studying, researching outcome-based pricing for 12 years. And the reality is that tech companies, you know, nobody likes it, right? It's too risky. It's too complicated. What do you measure? What customers don't want to contract that way. But it's always been a topic of discussion, right? Customers are like, look, I don't want to just pay for your software. I only want to pay if I get value slash an outcome. Our thesis in the world of AI is that, you know, obviously user-based pricing doesn't work well in the world of AI in the long term because all your customers are getting more efficient. So you start moving to consumption-based pricing, but we think there's too much value leakage there. Ultimately, some type of combination between like initial get on my platform baseline pricing plus outcome realization is going to be the end game. And I think what you just said is large companies, and I already see this, are really going to struggle with that thought, really going to struggle how to do that. But smaller companies are going to be more willing to experiment there with customers, more willing to be creative. And I do believe that AI is going to make outcome-based pricing something that is realistic for a technology provider in a way that 5 years ago you couldn't do. And I'm just intellectually curious. I mean, like, when you look at the pricing for software, I mean, and you guys debate this internally, where do you see
that? To answer that question, Thomas, if you don't mind, I'll take you a journey back 20 years. My first role as a CEO was a company that was public on NASDAQ, but sold into a very, very tight vertical, airlines. So, okay. You know, there aren't that many airlines in the world. Mm-hmm. And so sitting in front of Glenn Tilt at United Airlines in 2004 and explaining the license model was broken, you know, so we had to move to a more transaction outcome-based model.
Oh, interesting.
And what worked for him was, you know, his business at the time, United.com, did 2-3% of their revenue globally. And so we built all of the kind of pricing availability, like capability for United.com. And convincing him to move to a transaction model where every time somebody made a booking on United.com, I got paid as an outcome. And what he got paid was he got a booking, right? Like, so his average booking was $80. So he had an economic value to that. And I got essentially 50 cents. Okay.
Yeah.
The challenge with that model then is all of the pressure and the tension in that relationship is now on my side to make sure that I make that 50 cents that I get really efficient and ever more efficient.
Yeah.
And that's a great example of that aligned value and that aligned outcome. I agree that the world is going to move towards that. I'm not sure the pace of that is going to be as dramatic as the pace of change we're seeing in AI.
Yeah.
I think enterprises will be slower to adopt to that.
Yeah.
But I think companies our size, we can take more risk. We can be a little bit more engaged in that conversation with a customer because we're a little bit smaller, right? And we're not reporting to the market, you know, on our $6 billion worth of revenue this quarter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if we miss by 2%, the market tags our share. Like, so not being one of the incumbent, being a little bit more agile means we can take more risk around some of those things. And one of the things that myself and my management team are really looking at is where are the places where we will take more risk in our business model, our approach with our partners, our approach with our sales guys, our approach with our customers. So,
So what's really interesting, I'm going to go all the way back to this example you were using on the redaction. Another driver, we think, for moving more toward outcome-based pricing models, again, is this concept of value leakage. So use the example of selling it to airlines. Your driver there was licensing doesn't make sense because I got a small, tight market. I got to think of a different economic model here. The new reality with AI is, you know, this example, because you have these, you know, new AI capabilities, you've saved tons and tons of hours from customers on redaction. I mean, the dollar value of that was massive. It's massive. And so I think software vendors are going to start saying, look, if I just took out, make up a number, $20 million of cost with this feature, I don't want to charge this or just, you know, it's just rolled in or whatever. I got to figure out a new way of connecting the dots here so that, you know, you save $10 million and you just take 10% of that, that's net new revenue. Because what I see in AI again and again and again, the AI use cases, the ROI is not, hey, we're going to help you 5% or 10%. It's 30%, 40%, 50 cents. These are massive cost savings to customers for some of these use cases. And you guys are in the guts of that. I mean, you got use cases, I'm sure, that just unlock all kind of efficiencies. And that's just going to continue for you. So it really creates incentive to figure out different way to take that value off the table.
Exactly. And I'll give you the example I used earlier around our Smart Redact product, where there are 6,000 users in that business. Yeah. They don't want to have to pay a monthly increment or a user fee every month for those 6,000, because what's happening is those 6,000 users, they're kind of doing it two or three times a month. It's part of a workflow. It's not all they do. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And so actually the solution that we've put in front of them there is, you know, we'll do it on a document basis, right? You know, and that's a much more predictable outcome for the customer. That aligns the value and aligns the outcome, right? And so, you know, having that flexibility to do that, again, I think it's a little bit easier as a relatively smaller company than it is as one of the incumbent players.
Yeah, but it is interesting times. Again, I think a lot of the aspects of the software business model, the pricing model, that, you know, the how fast we release products, all these things are just changing right before our eyes. It's kind of crazy. So I'm watching the clock. I'm going to ask you one more question. You know, in the chair that you sit in, what are you most bullish about in terms of new or emerging AI capabilities? It's going to change, you know, what you can do for customers, the way you can do for business. What are you excited about?
I'm probably excited on a couple of different levels. Like one, I think that the talent that a small business like us has, I think we can get a lot more productivity by leveraging the same gray matter and the same people in a ever more augmented fashion. I think that's, again, like we're a business with 300 people in it. We're not a business with 3,000 or 30,000 in it.
Yeah.
And I think that's exciting. I think the market we're in, if I look forward even two or three years, which right now I think is really hard given that the market changes every 2 weeks, right?
Yeah.
But I think in a world where there's more and more dynamic AI generated content, the need for trusted, you know, immutable like sources of truth and storage will grow. And that means that things like PDF, you know, as a format becomes even more important. Certified signature, all of those things we do naturally within the workflows we're in today, I think become more important and less important. I'm not sure where that goes much beyond that three-year period. I certainly don't know anybody who could predict where things are going to be in 2030. But our challenge is within our products, do we have the ability to change how people will consume and interact with those workflows, with those documents? We're already seeing that move towards what we call smart tools and smarter ways. And we think over time, those smart tools will handle more and more of the mundane for you. Like, you know, redaction is an example. That's not something anybody jumps out of bed to do in the morning, right? Even in a government administration, right? And just the ability to make sure that you've got the pertinent information you need to take action. That action is, it's easy for you to review, and then you can get to that outcome really quickly. That's what I'm excited about. And look, I've always loved competing against the incumbents who are 100 times my size, and I always like our odds against those guys. So, you know, they're probably the things that
most excited about.
Yeah.
Well, and one thing you're on there again is about technology just taking a lot of the mundane activities off the table. I mean, that's one thing I personally am super excited about, because I already see it in my job as a researcher. I see it in just so many different use cases. And, you know, it's really interesting right now, sort of the talk track around technology and AI, et cetera. And there's more and more sort of pushback and concern in all these things. And I, you know, there's a lot of things that are warranted there. But what I think is getting lost in that is really how much just boring shit it's going to go off the table of a professional. And because of AI, which is really, it just allows you to, as a professional, to just say, look, I don't have to do that stuff. Like you said, nobody jumps out of bed if they want to do redaction, but they want to do like, hey, I got to do a super important review on this contract or this document or whatever that's really important to the business. That's what they want to focus on. And so AI is a game changer for, I think, almost every professional in changing the balance of how they have to spend their day. And I personally, I'm super bullish on that.
I'd agree. I mean, like, I'm a terrible administrator of, expenses, doing reviews, even responding to emails. Like, I'm an awful administrator. I'm not sure I'm much better at anything else, by the way. But I don't get energy from any of that. But put me in front of partners, put me in a room with a customer, put me in a room with our employees. Like, that's the stuff I love about my job. I love negotiating. Like, they're the things that I like to get in rooms and do. And the more of the mundane stuff that I can make easy and still do well, think that's what AI is going to solve for the world, right?
Sure. Yeah, no, I agree. Well, Cormac, I really appreciate you coming into Tectonic and enjoyed the conversation and wish you luck as you, again, you're in a tough chair nowadays. And so it's going to be fun times over the next couple of years. But I'd like to close these episodes with a question of the day. And so for all the software companies that are listening, it has never been harder to differentiate yourself. How solid is your value story? Cheers, everybody.